Okay, it is Sunday, October 14th, 2018. It's about 1 p.m. I'm with Richard Brancifort. Am I pronouncing it?
Brancifort.
Brancifort in Queens, the Queens College Library, and we're going to do an interview for Queens Memory Project, focusing on the Queens College house plans. But I guess before we get to the house plans, I guess. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to high school? And first, what made you come to Queens College? So we'll get everything before Queens College.
Grew up right here in Jamaica, Union Turnpike, 168th Street. Went to Jamaica High School, then with Junior High School, and came to Queens College because it was inexpensive. It was only $19 a semester,
Right. This is what
and
year?
this was 1963. And I had applied to St. John's University in Queens, and I got accepted to both. And I didn't want to go to an all-Catholic university, so I had a lot of friends from high school that were going to Queens, and parents couldn't afford to send me any place that would have been a lot more expensive, and Queens was a very good school, and wound
So
up here.
you were right next door to St. John's,
Yep, I could
basically.
walk to it. I lived there from when it was a golf course.
Ah,
It was a
so
golf course before they turned it into St. John's University.
when was that? Do you have vague recollection?
50s.
50s,
50s,
okay.
I think St. John's moved in there about 60.
And when it started, it was really a Catholic college, unlike
It was a,
now.
yeah, it was almost all Catholic and a lot of, and I was Catholic, but I just didn't want to.
Right. So did you and many of your friends come to Queens College together?
We all, I guess, applied separately, but we all wound up here. So when we came to freshman orientation, you ran into all your friends from Jamaica High School that you and junior high school that you hadn't realized were even applying. And Paul Simon played for my freshman orientation in Coleman Center for the incoming freshman.
He was still at the college, or he had
He was still
graduated?
at the college. He was a senior. This was before Simon and Garfunkel.
Okay. So you had a bunch of friends here. You didn't live too far from here. So, but did you, was your, at least at the start, was your social life at the college? I guess I'm wondering what made you join a house plan, or at that time, house plans were such a big thing that
Well,
everyone
actually,
joined.
when we came here, house plans weren't very big. Fraternities and sororities were very big. And the house plans, their appeal was that you could join as a lower freshman. And myself and two of my friends went to a rush party at one of the house plans. And when we went in there, the guys were just talking about, well, I guess it's going to be another year. We're not going to get very many parties with the good house plans. And we're going to lose again in intramurals. And so the three of us walked out, and I just turned to the other two guys and I said, look, we ought to start our own house plan because anything we start has to be bigger than that. And we started Kingston House in September 1963. I was here 2 weeks and we started.
Where were most of the houses for the
There
house
were no
plan?
houses. That was the thing. Fraternities had fraternity houses, which was the big appeal.
And do you remember where the fraternity houses
Oh, sure.
were?
They were right. A. Pye's house was right off Union Turnpike, off of Parsons Boulevard, which is real close to here. Phi Epsilon's house was around the corner from there. And they were the two top fraternities at the college, so they were the place that was like a triangle that all the sororities and everybody else. And back in those days, sororities would never have parties with houseplants. They only would have parties with fraternities, and each, there was a hierarchy within the fraternities and sororities, so certain sororities would only party with certain male fraternities.
It's funny because I think, Queens College is a communal school. One doesn't think of it in terms of fraternities and sororities and
Well, the CMC, the College Memorial Center, was the center of our universe. That's where everybody hung out from house plans. The fraternities pretty much controlled the cafeteria, and you couldn't sit in certain sections.
So
If you,
where on the grounds of the college was the CMC?
it's right next door to the cafeteria. It's the science building now, the computer center. Computer center is the college, and in there was the Students for Democratic Society, Student Help Project, all the civil rights organizations were in there. The school newspaper, the Phoenix, was in there. Central House Plan, Interfraternity Council, and Panhellenic Council. So we used to hang out in the CMC, and we would stay as late as we could.
Which was what time did they kick you out?
Well, they didn't kick you out because there was night school here, so you could stay literally until 10 o'clock at night. But in my lower sophomore year, I found a house for us on 169th Street and Union Turnpike, which ironically, or luckily, was one block from where I lived.
So that, none of them were on Reeves Avenue or near the college?
Nobody had anything. There was one house plan, had a house in Flushing off of Northern Boulevard. We were the second or third house plan to actually get a house. Mm-hmm. And that made us, because we were suddenly a place that not only could have parties, but you could hang out there. Mm-hmm. Sororities would come over, house plans would come over. Well, the guys, they would hang out day and night. Mm-hmm. They would hang out day and night. Yeah. And when guys had fights with their parents, they would move into the house because we had three bedrooms. Right.
I was wondering, because it's, while close to the college, Union and 169th, it's not around the corner.
Yeah, none
That's
of
why I was wondering if it was Reeves or places where you could just walk over.
No.
I mean, I grew up across the street from the college, so when I didn't have classes, I just went home. But I remember there were people
who
would
have... Well, the guys that were in Kingston House, I mean, the original group was from Jamaica, but within about a month, the guys were all from Jamaica High School, Francis Lewis High School, and Bayside High School.
Oh, so they weren't...
So we, you know, one guy said I would know somebody, and they would know somebody else that lived... So the guys tended to be from Jamaica, Bayside, Fresh Meadows, Flushing, Briarwood, and it was a central location, and most of the guys didn't drive in those days.
Right.
So you had the bus right by our door, and like I said, I didn't have to worry about that.
Right, because you
was a block
over.
Away.
Okay, can you explain to me about, and for everyone else, the difference between a house plan and, let's say, fraternity or sorority in terms of both, I guess, getting accepted, expenses, values, what they did?
Well, fraternities and sororities, first of all, had national affiliations, so they had money. The nationals would help them out. They would have all kinds of support. House plans started in 1937 at City College, and the original house plans were very... very encompassing in that the way they worked it is anybody that wanted to join a house plan got assigned to a house. Mm-hmm. When we got here, we changed it a bit. There was no pledging technically, but we came out with a system called trying out, which was like pledging. It wasn't, there was no hazing, but we would get maybe 40 or 50 guys that would come down that wanted to join the house, and we would maybe take in 20 or 25. Mm-hmm. So for about 2 months, these guys came to the house, they hung out. They did stuff around the house. They joined in football or follies and frolics. And after a while, the house plans became much closer to the fraternities. And that was in 63, 64. 64 was the big turnover year. That was the year that a lot of house plans were started on Queens College campus. And we became more of a force within the school, because when we came here, it was real simple. AEPI fraternity had the president of the school. Phi Ep fraternity had the chief justice of the student court. The majority of student senate was fraternity members. There was almost nobody from house plans in there. And they had an event called Follies, which was a big skit thing every year that DFIE sorority ran. But AEPI had won it 5 years in a row. And part of the reason was that Paul Simon wrote the skits for AEPI. And in 1964, Kingston House placed second, and we thought we should have won, and once again, AEPI won. So it was the first time in the history of the school that a house plan placed, and after that, the house plan started growing.
Can I ask you, in terms of the composition of the house plan, were there like with sororities and fraternities, were those that were like Catholic ones or Jewish ones, or you had a mix?
Yeah, Kingston House was particularly... interesting, because when I originally wrote the Constitution for Kingston House, I put down that a quorum shall be a minion. And I still have the Constitution. Actually, I brought it with me, but we were rejected, and they wrote on it, cannot be a religious background. Queens College in the day was overwhelmingly Jewish, and I was Catholic, and the vice president was Protestant. And we rewrote the Constitution, and for years, the house plan was very, very everybody. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any, like, somebody didn't get in because they were Jewish, so we didn't have to vote against somebody because they weren't Jewish. And we were, you know, we had a great mix of guys. They were tall, they were short. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a stereotypical, this is mm-hmm. what the guys mm-hmm. look like. We were all sizes and shapes mm-hmm. and interests and backgrounds.
And what was, I mean, I think believe that House Plans did positive things for the community or the college besides being places where guys could socialize.
Yeah, I mean, there was a million activities that went on. We used to have a carnival every year where money would be raised for charity. We, Kingston House and a lot of the other House Plans brought guest speakers on. Mm-hmm. We formed a thing called the Mock Gubernatorial Convention, and it was like held in the off year. But when they were having the gubernatorial election and all the different organizations that were House Plans represented different candidates. So if it was Joseph Carlino or Howard Samuels, they were all running, you would try and get your candidate to win, always money donated to mm-hmm. charities. And then we came up with the idea of frolics because we were so upset that the House Plans couldn't win follies. So we started our own show called Frolics. But there was a lot of...
And those were held at the college? At
Colton Center. Colton Center. We used to sell out 2,000 seats for all the events, and Follies was the big thing. If you made it into Follies, you were...
And the seats were sold to the general public?
Yeah, but it would be basically...
Mostly the family,
you know,
spreads.
There were 60 House Plans on campus, and there was about 25 fraternities and sororities, and you got allotted a certain number of tickets, and the tickets would all be sold out. Right. And it was just... It was, you know, really major time productions, and the rehearsals were the fun part. A lot of guys met their girlfriends at the rehearsals. You went to the rehearsal and you didn't know anybody, and then all of a sudden you're there 4 nights a week rehearsing. And
so when did you ever have time for schoolwork?
We didn't. School
but
was,
you managed to graduate? I see you were there for a long time.
I was there 4 years.
Oh, because it says you were, okay, so maybe.
63 to 67.
Okay, because here on the information that they gave me from the library, they said you were president of Metropolitan House Plan
yeah.
from 67 to 69.
Yeah, what happened there was very simple. Like a lot of people, I mean, it was the wartime, and I had got accepted to Columbia Graduate School mm-hmm. of Business. And I was
so
totally...
So I guess you did well here, despite...
No, I didn't do well here. We recently found my report cards, which my son who went to Cornell laughed at. I was not a strong student. I was very good in political science and history, and anything that was science, math, I was horrendous at.
So back then there were requirements in each?
Yeah, there were requirements. You had to take a language. I took French, which I loved. I took English, which I got a D in English 1, which is ironic because for the last 49 years I've been editor of a newspaper, and I've had 14 newspapers over the years. and my first job was with AT&T with the management magazine. But I was one of those people that really loved it here. And all my friends were still at the college. And the guys that had come in like in 64 and 65 were real good friends. So I still went back to the house. And I came up with this idea of a umbrella, just like Central House Plan was the umbrella for all the individual house plans at Queens College. I formed the Metropolitan House Plan Association, which was an umbrella organization for all the city college campuses throughout mm-hmm. the city. So we had Brooklyn College, Baruch, Hunter, Lehman, the Queensborough kind of college. The only college that wouldn't join is City College. And their reasoning was, and I just found a letter from them, and I still have it at home, the reasoning was that they thought all the other schools had perverted the original intention of House Plans being just equal. And by having any kind of rushing or by having it that you brought down a friend was against their original idea that it was like a draft. You came down, you signed up, and they assigned you to a house plan randomly. So three friends couldn't be in the same house plan. They would all be spread out.
The idea being that you would meet new people and join yep. friendships.
So the Metro Holland House Plan Association lasted 2 years. And then the real world followed, and I graduated from Columbia Business School.
Oh, well. Can I ask you about some of the events? Okay, I grew up across the street from Queens College, and I have this memory of it must have been about 9-10, so it's got to be the mid-60s, a Halloween haunted house. What used to be the parking lot is now the science building. Was that from houseplants? Was that from sorority fraternities?
Don't know. I mean, the carnival was a big thing. And that could have been part of carnival.
Ah.
And carnival was just exactly that. You had all kinds of booths and games and things. But the fraternities didn't really do too much in the mid to late 60s because they were in decline. The houseplants had taken over. We got the president and the vice president of the school. We got mm-hmm. two-thirds of the student senate. The editor of the school newspaper was Vima mm-hmm. Houseplan. And we had 3,000 members.
Oh, that was, you know. So. And how did the administration, was in favor of House?
No. No, as a matter of fact, the famous time, we had Castle, which was a student newspaper. Have you ever seen it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
There were how many student newspapers back there?
Well, here's the thing. There, the school, because in those days there was a dress code.
Right.
And there was a school rule there could only be one school newspaper, which was the Phoenix. Phoenix had started in 1959 when they merged two other papers together. And Castle, under the leadership of Gary Ackerman, who the congressman,
right.
became a regular newspaper like this. So the school banned the Castle from publishing because they said we were too much like a real newspaper. And there were all kinds of protests. And there was a famous protest that Gary led. Even back then, Gary was
right.
the showman. But what he did was he rented a hearse and he rented a coffin. And we went to the student CMC, College Memorial Center, and we filled the coffin with back issues of Castle. And we printed an issue of Castle that was totally blank. And it said, we are not allowed to publish any news by rule of the Queens College Administration. And we filled the coffin with the Castles and about 25 people all dressed in black. We carried the coffin filled with Castles to Colden Center where we had a funeral and a wake. And Gary got up on stage and he said, we have come to bury Castle, not to praise it. And then we put a lot of pressure on the administration, and by then things were changing because the fraternities naturally didn't want there to be a houseplant newspaper that was strong. They didn't have a newspaper. So they were more than happy that we were banned because we couldn't disseminate who was having a party, that there was rushes. But they finally reinstated the Castle. First, they limited us to 4 pages mimeoed. And then they revoked it and said, okay, you can do what
Your
you want.
Deal.
And I actually became Castle editor after Gary.
And then Gary went on to be the, I can't remember which paper he founded.
Queen's Tribune.
Flushing, which
Queen's,
was first
it was the Flushing Tribune, yeah.
Then. Yes, and then Gary, when he protested to get paternity leave, I
yep.
remember when
yep.
he was
doing,
yeah. Yep. If I could ask him, we can take it off. How is Gary?
He's good. He's
you
good.
Know,
I
he
had
was
to,
sick. From,
yeah. I had lunch with him about 2 months ago, and then about a month and a half ago, he and Rita had him over to my house for dinner. I hadn't seen Rita since his wedding.
Oh,
I was
God.
At his wedding with Lenny Schutzman. Do you know Lenny?
Yeah.
He's contributed like quite a lot of money to the School of Entrepreneurial Studies.
Mm-hmm.
We went over all the stuff, and Gary, we had great stories about you know, being a congressman. But 80% of the time we spent going over
houseplant
stuff because he founded a houseplant called Playboy's Penthouse. And they were the fourth group to have they had an apartment in Flushing.
Oh.
And Rita, his wife, says, I was an honorary member of Playboy's Penthouse. That's
what did the
Rita.
College feel about that name, or by that point things were loosening
well,
up?
Well, Gary obviously took the name because that's when Hugh Hefner had Playboy's Penthouse. That's why
right.
he took the name. But I don't think they really got that involved in it. They kind of ignored houseplants until we became powerful. And that was 64, 65.
Now, did houseplants have to pay a fee to the college
no.
or anything?
No. We had meetings every week. There was a meeting in one of the science rooms or one of the social science building. And you'd have your meeting. And then we had central houseplant meetings every week, which was one representative from each houseplant, so there would be like 40, 50, 60 people at that. But, you know, by then they had more important things to worry about because the war was starting
right.
to really heat up. And, you know, we had gotten here, and the whole thing with Goodman That was right around the time when I first came into the college. So civil rights was really starting to take off on the campus, marches, protests. And
so house plans weren't seen as something old-fashioned to be.
That came later. That came in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've done a lot of research, I have at least, trying to find out when they actually went out. And it seems like most people grew around 73, 74. We went from 3,000 people in 1969 and 60 house plans. It's almost like the dinosaurs got wiped out. And then 4 years later, there was nobody left. It was no house plans, and nobody knows exactly.
I came in 72. Yeah, 72. And I don't remember house plans. I remember I had a friend who had an older sister who had gone. She was like 8 years older than me. And she was in a house plan. And her boyfriend was in a house plan.
Well, our house plan, Kingston House, voted itself out of existence in 71. And I was just talking to two of the younger guys. They graduated in 72. And they said by that time, it wasn't really cohesive anymore. The original group of guys, I mean, there was like 40 guys that were together for almost 4 years. But they became irrelevant. Social issues became important, and it became very uncool to be in something as flighty as a house plan. And while the war was going on. One of the guys at the Brunch Dish now said, so what did people do for social things? In the,
well, where did they hang out when they had 7 hours between classes? I mean, that's one of the things I remember is when you registered for classes, it wasn't like now you do it all on the computer, you could see, I've got a space.
You used to have to wait online.
End up with 7 hours between classes.
You used to have to wait online in Fitzgerald Gym, and the courses that you usually wanted who had the easy teachers or the good teachers, they would fill up immediately. So until you were like a junior, you couldn't really get the teachers that you wanted. But yeah, and that's why we spent so much time in the CMC. By the time 66 rolled around and we were really very, very strong as house plans, we kind of took over the cafeteria. We took over like about a third of the cafeteria became house plan seats. Mm-hmm. And the fraternities and sororities were still there, but we had
kind of... So what did poor people who didn't belong to anything do?
We gentrified the cafeteria. They were on the outskirts. On the outskirts, there was the edges that you could sit in.
And it was just sort of known by everyone.
But we still stayed in the CMC because there was three or four house plants that was their hangout. Mm-hmm. The chairs, the lounges, we had all the offices there, like I said.
Mm-hmm. But once you had your own house, did most of the guys go there if they had long breaks?
No.
Stayed here. That was for the evening.
Only if they had girlfriends.
Okay. Okay, we'll stop there. We don't want to go into... None of you are going to be Supreme Court justices.
No, I'm afraid not.
Besides Garrett, are there any other strong personalities who were involved with great stories about house plan activities? Okay, well, we can talk about Paul Simon and the house plans and not house plans. That was a fraternity.
He was AE Pi fraternity. They were our hated rivals. Mm-hmm. And the Kingston House skit in 66, actually reproduced to the most minute detail AE Pi's winning skit from the year before, which was George Washington crossing the Delaware. And the scene opened, as the curtains opened, we were on stage dressed as George Washington crossing the Delaware. And the last song in our, because Stan Blyman and Vic Blum, who were very good singer-songwriters, wrote the script and all, and the last line was where they pointed to the 85 section, was, "You will win again." And the whole idea was, it doesn't matter what we do, it doesn't matter how good we are, you will win again. It was just a refrain that kept going out. And they did. And, you know, their motto every year was 5 and 65, 6 and 66, and they wanted to...
So there were specific guys within your house plan who would write the shows?
Yep. You know, like anything else, the house plan was a microcosm of reality. There was the jocks, the sports guys. There was what we call the card players. They would Friday nights be playing cards. There was the politicos. They were the guys that were running for different offices. And there was the social. We had parties every Friday and Saturday night. Well, Friday night was party night. Saturday night was date night pretty much at the house. And there was, you know, interaction. Somebody could be in the political group and the social group. But, yeah, there was definitely, and then we had very, very strong intramural teams, football, basketball, volleyball. So Kingston, the reason it got so big, we had 85 guys when I graduated, was that it
what
was...
What was the average size of the house?
Average house plan would be 25 to 35.
Oh, you really were big.
But then there was the mega house plans. There was Random House. There was State House. There was Big House. Kingston House. We all had 70-plus members. Then there was the female housemans with Dewdrop in, Doll House, Tiptoe in, Ivy House. They were like the upper tier, and they had the same thing, 16 and 70. And the reason we were able to pretty much do what we wanted in politics was we put together a coalition of house plans. When I became president in 66 in the spring semester, because the president, we got impeached. President Central House Plan was impeached.
Because?
He did a lot of things. He didn't want to be bothered. He did nothing for the organization. He was supporting fraternity guys that would run for office. Oh. And he, famous quote was, you know, I'd be happy if nobody bothered me in my office for my whole term. So he got impeached. And then there was a very heated competition for president, and I won. I had lost running the first time against him by one vote. I lost by one vote, and then I won in the, I was president for three semesters. And we just started really, we, little by little, we took over the school. We got the president of the college, vice president of the college. Ben Fine stands out from Playboy's Penthouse. He was Gary's protege. And Lenny Schutzman, who's a big donator to the college, he was our vice president. So the coalition was Playboy's Penthouse and Kingston House. Mm-hmm. And the thing that made us so powerful was that our sister house plans were Doll House and Dewdrop. And then we got all these little house plans that had just formed. You had one vote each. Yeah. So on any given vote, like for a general election, just the three of us, Kingston, Dewdrop, and Doll House, could muster over 200 votes. And we voted as a block. We actually went there, and every single person from the house plan had a lineup, and they had a vote. And we didn't know who they voted for, but you knew who they voted for. But if you could turn out 200 people as a block, you could basically control who was doing it. And I remember there was a famous situation. I told Gary, he claims he doesn't remember this, but we had a meeting at Dante's Restaurant on Union Turnpike and 168th Street. And he wanted to take Lenny off of the ticket. It was Ben Fine and Lenny, president, vice president of the school. And he said he didn't think that Lenny was strong enough candidate. And it was me and Harry Nass. Harry Nass was another guy that came out of Queens College. He became assistant to the borough president. He passed away 2 years ago, but he became assistant to the borough president. He got very active in Democratic politics because I brought him into the Jamaica Democratic Club. And we had this famous meeting called it the Showdown at the OK Corral, and it was at Dante's Restaurant. And Gary said they were going to replace Lenny on the ticket. And Harry and I were there, and we just said, if Lenny is taken off the ticket, then all 200 votes from Kingston House, Dewdrop, and Doll House will vote for the fraternity candidate for president of the school instead of Ben Fine. And Lenny stayed on the ticket.
You had power.
Well, that's what it was. It was constant fights. I mean, you know, it was power at its very rawest. I mean, then there was the thing on campus, you know, Students for Democratic Society, but there's also the Young Americans for Freedom, YAF, which was really ultra-right-wing conservative group. This guy, Gary Lane, that was here, and he was a real right-winger. He once got up in one of our political science courses and said he had it on good authority. The United States was training Congolese Bantu warriors in the Everglades to take over the United States government. Unbelievable stuff like that. You think it's bad now? In the 60s, with Goldwater and the war and everything, it was pretty strange.
So within the house plans, your house plan, let's say, were there political fights? Were there
No. There were internal political fights. Like
but not external.
Two of us would run against each other for president or vice president of Kingston House.
But not external.
No.
You were all pretty much the same.
We were there. If somebody from Kingston House was running for the Senate, then every single person in the House plan would vote to support them in the Senate. And when I graduated in 67, 25% of the entire student Senate came from Kingston House.
Wow.
And Harry Nass became vice president of the school.
Mm-hmm. Now, the student senate was pretty powerful within the college. And what did it do? I mean, what was
it? It set down the laws. It passed things. Theoretically, it was an advisor to the administration on different issues.
Mm-hmm. Did it control money for activities?
Yes. It controlled money for activities, and if they withheld money, you didn't do certain activities. And if there was a controversy, it would go to the student court, which was, like I said, FIAP, Chief Justice, and then everybody was fraternities. There weren't sororities on these things back then.
It was a very male thing. So if I can ask about the female houseplants, when they were equal participants in the events and the Frollies and the whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it was like, it was a coup to get with certain houseplants. Like, one of the things that made Kingston House, the first year we were with a good houseplant, but the second year we dumped them. It was very awkward because my girlfriend that I met my second week of college was in the first houseplant.
Why did you dump them?
It was just strictly... the guys had an opportunity to go into Follies with Dew Drop In.
And they had more talented.
Dew Drop In was just the upper echelon of the female houseplants. So by going into Follies with them, A, it meant we would have parties with them regularly. And then B, it meant that the other top echelon female houseplants would say, oh, Kingston House and Dew Drop In, and they would have parties. Ironically, here's an interesting statistic. 22 guys from Kingston House married girls from Dew Drop In, and at the 2006 reunion, 20 out of 22 was still married to the same person.
Wow.
So you talk about
to you and your girlfriend who was in the
house? We were four years together, and then I went to graduate school, and she wanted to get married, and I didn't want to get married. I was 19 years old, and so I went to Columbia Business School. And my girlfriend, while I was in Columbia Business School, was from Tiptoeing and from Follies, or Frolics. And I met her at a Frolics rehearsal because I was still coming back.
Right.
All my friends were still here, so I was still coming back. I didn't like Columbia. It was very hard. And there was a very big prejudice against City University students. The people who went to Columbia Business School were from Harvard. They were from University of North Carolina. I ran for president of the school, and I lost to Chester Bowles' nephew, Erskine Bowles, who became Clinton's chief of staff. And there was a hierarchy in the business school like I didn't understand, that it was all based on your family and where you went to school. And we had this little group of City University kids.
So you didn't do well in school, and you were from a city college, but you got in, so you might... I guess maybe your leadership in houseplants got you in.
I always told my son, he got into Cornell University and he had an amazingly high average, but so did every other kid from Roslyn. But he was an Eagle Scout. And he was in a lot of things, marching band and stuff. When I went up, I had a 2.5 index from Queens College. And I applied to NYU, and I applied to Baruch, and I applied to Columbia. I got into Baruch right away, and I got a letter from NYU, and NYU at the time was like the 200th business school in the country.
Right.
Columbia was number three.
Right.
So they were just starting. They were really feeling their oats. So they sent me a letter that said, "Dear Mr. Bransfort, unfortunately, you do not meet the high academic standards that NYU has. We are unable to accept you. Please, we hope you find some way of continuing your education." Okay, so I get an invite. Columbia was on a trimester program. So we graduated in June, whenever it was.
Right.
And all my friends were going to Europe. They were going cross country. And each semester was equal, supposedly, but really like any place else, fall and spring were the important ones. But the June semester was a trimester. So they said, "We want you to come down for an in-person interview." So I go up to Washington Heights. I'd never been up there. I get off at the wrong stop, and I get off in the middle of Harlem. And here I am, a white guy, dressed in a three-piece suit with wingtip shoes, and I'm walking up Morningside Heights. And this is after the riots in Harlem over Columbia's expansion into Morningside Heights. And I'm walking, I walk into this business school, and I'm sweating. Because I instead of taking the number one, I took the number three or something. So I get there, and I was early. So I went into the newspaper office, and there was this guy, Vince, and I introduced myself, and I said, yeah, I'm the editor of the Castle, and I started an MHPA in the house by a newspaper called The Beacon. And I said, yeah, I just want to see what the newspaper office looks like. And the guy says, right. And I said, yeah, I do. I've edited newspapers, and I do a lot of writing. And he said to me, I'm a very good writer. He says, but I don't know anything about newspapers. And I said, I know how to lay out newspapers, design newspapers, edit them. So he said, great, I hope you get in because I could really use the help. So I go to the interview, and there's three people in the room. One's the dean of admissions. One's a guy sitting in the back, Mike. And going over my grades, and I had only taken one economics course at Queens College with Dr. Withers, A.A. Withers. And I got an A in the course. Changed my grade from A minus to A because I told him, Withers, I need an A in this course. It's my only economics course. I decided I wanted to go to business school later. I was going to go to law school. My whole career, I thought I was a political science major. I was going to law school. And then I saw a copy of Esquire magazine. And on the cover of Esquire magazine was a guy with a wheelbarrow, and it was filled with money. And the article was basically that if you got your MBA, you too could have a wheelbarrow full of money.
So I applied
to schools, so I got in. And about a week later, I get an acceptance letter. And one of the questions they asked me, I'm sitting there, and they said, well, if you got into Columbia Business School, would you be interested in working on the school newspaper? And I said, well, actually, I've already met Vince, the editor, and I told him I'd very much like to be on the paper. So I get 2 weeks later, I get my congratulations acceptance letter to Columbia Business School. I take a copy of the letter. I send it to NYU. with a copy of that letter and said, I found a way.
Ooh.
Got into the number three school over the number 200 school. And I went to Columbia and was there for 2 years. And
did you work harder at Columbia? Or
Columbia I was very ill-prepared for. My low grades and my low attendance did not help me. I was used to breezing through courses like history. And I hadn't had math since I was in the ninth grade.
Oh. How'd you get out of high school?
Well, in junior high school and high school, they gave you an option of math or science.
Oh, so you just
so I had algebra was the last course I ever took. Maybe it was even geometry. And I never took another math course again. I took physics, which I did horrible in. All the courses I got D's in were like math courses. For. Yeah. So I go into the course, and I'm taking a course in macroeconomics. And from the minute I walked into the class, the professor never spoke in English. He only spoke in equations. And he was doing calculus. And I had never taken any math. So they sent me into a remedial non-credit calculus course to take simultaneously with the course. Well, I got a D in macroeconomics. And I seriously, meanwhile, now this is like August. And I'm seriously thinking to myself, hey, I'm not cut out to be in this school. Everybody's so brilliant. And the guys were so old. You know,
they had all worked.
The guys from CUNY were kids like me. But these guys were Green Berets. They had been in Vietnam for a couple of years, or they worked for Procter & Gamble for 7 years, and now they were going back. One woman in the entire school, and she was gorgeous. And every single guy in the school fell in love with this one girl.
Do you remember who she was or what became of her? Did she
actually somebody? Oh, yeah. Her name is Sue. And somebody recently told me, oh, yeah, we were talking about old girlfriends and stuff like that. Oh, yeah, she's
head of something.
Hedge fund, president of a hedge fund and stuff. But so I wasn't prepared really for graduate school. And I was going to drop out and go to Baruch instead. And then at the last minute, I decided to stay in school. And I graduated by the skin of my teeth because I failed. The last course I had to fail course in computers. Computers were just starting, but they were the huge size of this room.
Rooms, yeah.
So I was failing the course, and a friend of mine, who was the photographer of the paper with me, had been a submarine commander. So he knew all this stuff. He was trying to tutor me. And I got a 20 on my computer course. And the professor said, I'm going to let you take a makeup test. And I needed that course to graduate. I wasn't going to be able to graduate if I failed that course. And I studied like I've never studied before, and I understood nothing. I walked into the class, and I said, okay, this is it. I walk into the class, and he hands me the paper. And instead of it being all equations and problems, it's an essay. How can this course be made easier for non-mathematically inclined students? And I got an A on it.
So you passed.
And I passed. And I also lucked out because Spring 69, Students for Democratic Society, Mark Rudd, took over Columbia University and shut it down.
All right.
So you had the radicals, which was everybody on the campus. And in the middle of this thing, you had this little business school that was Green Berets. And their idea was they were hatching up plans in the lobby of taking back the school by getting all the Green Beret guys together to break through and beat the heck out of the demonstrators and take back the business school. I lucked out because Columbia went pass-fail my last semester.
Oh.
And I had a course called Business Organization, my last course. I invented the Dole banana.
Really?
Invented the Dole banana. Never got credit for it. But the last course we took, and we were talking about it last night at the president's get-together because somebody else said, the Dole banana. But Castle and Cook was the name of the company. They owned Dole Pineapple. And they own a non-name banana company, and they own Bumblebee Tuna, and they owned a shipping company, and they owned all this land, pineapples and stuff in Hawaii. And my dad had owned a supermarket, and he had all the grocers' magazines going back to the 1940s. So I came up with this whole paper, and we worked in a team of three, a marketing guy, an accounting guy, and and I came up with this idea that we're going to take the bumblebee tuna, we're going to bring it through the Panama Canal, we're going to process it, and then we're going to pick up the bananas, and we're going to bring them. And I came up with the idea that all surveys showed that of Dole, Del Monte, and Libby's, Dole was considered to be, pineapple was considered to be the best quality. And in those days, there wasn't anything called market extension. You had a brand, and that was the brand. There wasn't five different versions of Kellogg's K. And I came up with the idea of they were going to spend something like $5 million to introduce a new brand name for their bananas, which didn't happen because Chiquita ruled the market.
Right.
And I came up with the idea, and I said, why don't we just call them Dole Bananas? Everybody knows the name Dole, and it's synonymous with good quality. So two things happened. I handed in the paper. I got an A in the course. And I always kidded around because part of the thing was that you had to, all the papers became the property of Castle and Cook. And I always kidded around. I said, I'd be willing to bet you anything that my professor, 1972, I graduated in 69. 1972, my father was just on the way out for his supermarket. He was getting out of the grocery business. He had gotten robbed so many times. He was in Jackson Heights. He comes home. He flips a banana onto our table. And right in the middle is the Dole logo.
Oh.
And he says, remember that ID you had 4 years ago? Were you using all my different magazines? He says, well, here's the Dole banana. I never even thought about what happened to doing the whole thing. But it was an experience because Queens College to me was like you could cruise through in your sleep. Because everybody that was here was pretty bright. They were pretty bright. It was a great school. We loved it. And to this day, the guys get together and they still talk about there's a bunch of old guys sitting around saying, oh, the happiest days of our life were back on the Queens College campus. And it was. It was a great time. The World's Fair, 64, 65 was there. It was an unusual time that just, if we would have been off by 3 years, if we would have been off by just 3 years, like the guys from 72, that two guys that are here today from Kingstown, they didn't have that same thing. They didn't have the camaraderie. Yeah, we had the house. But it was like hard to get guys to go to parties and stuff. And we always,
world changed.
They always say, this guy just told me today, We were all jealous of you guys. You had it all. You were kings of the school. You had all these great activities. You had all this great fun. And look at, you know, 50 years later, the same group of guys are still hanging out together.
That's wonderful.
And friends. And it's all because of Queens College.
Since you're on Queens College, are there any professors, administrators, whatever, who you remember?
Oh, yeah.
We can speak for a little while.
How much time do we have?
We have about 12 minutes.
Okay. Last night at the president's meeting, it was, you know, he was taking questions. Mm-hmm. Nobody was asking questions. So I just kind of shouted out, since this isn't really a question, but anybody that had Willie Withers for economics or Mary Earhart Dillon for poli-sci, meet me afterwards. I'd love to exchange some stories. Well, 6-7 people came over. There was more activity on that. When he asked about houseplants, everybody kind of looked at each other because it wasn't a houseplant group last night. And Mary Dillon, everybody rumored, was Amelia Earhart's sister or stepsister because her name was Mary Earhart Dillon. And I didn't just, one of the guys who's a judge that I met last night just handed me this paper today on Mary Earhart Dillon that he did, a presentation he did here at the college about her. And apparently she was very tight with Wendell Willkie.
Oh, wow.
And she was very into, and she was a little bit too liberal for the women at the time. Mm-hmm. But she was one who stood out. I will always remember Willie Withers because he gave me the A. Mm-hmm. And then two professors that really stand out more than anybody. Sol Lutnick. Sol Lutnick was history department. And he was phenomenal. He would make the lessons something. He would talk about the Viceroy of New York, and when he came out in his dress, the crowd would applaud. And he had these great stories about, you know, just meaning, oh, and it was very cold in the wintertime here, so bundling was very, very popular amongst the sexes. And 1964, I will always remember this, he wrote a book called The Politics of Oil. And nobody thought anything about it because it was 1964, but his whole premise was that the entire Middle East has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with sex. Now, this is before Israel 67 war, right. But his whole premise was that everybody had been fighting forever, the British and the French, particularly in Iraq and all, for the oil fields. Whoever controlled the oil fields controlled the world. And I always thought, I said that to somebody yesterday, I said his insight was incredible because that was 36, 54 years ago, and still true. And then the other professor that I really remember very well is Dr. Hershkowitz in the history department. And he wrote a book, which was a fantastic book, called Boss Tweed, The History of Boss Tweed in Politics and How He Corrupted the Political System Forever. And I remember, not only because I loved American history, but I worked for him, and my job was to go into the stacks of the library, the old library, Clapper Library, I think it was.
Yeah.
And we used to be in the basement, and it was dirty and dark and musty, and we'd be going through these papers that were from, like, you know, excuse me, the 1800s, and he was just a fantastic, fantastic teacher.
Did you ever have Dr. Schwartz in the, Ernst Schwartz in the history department?
You know, I'm not sure.
The reason I asked, my father, after high school, he went to Brooklyn College for a year, didn't do well, he wasn't serious, went to work, whatever, he came back. When they moved to Queens, across from Queens College, he went back to Queens College and he majored in history. And I remember being like a 7-year-old girl, and it was 6-year-old. There was this assumption, I think, if you lived in Queens, you were going to go to Queens College. And we're taking a walk with my parents on the college grounds. Some Saturday afternoon, and Dr. Schwartz was walking with his wife, and he said, my father said, oh, this is my daughter. And he said, oh, what year will she be? And it was like, oh, she's going to be class of 76, and this is like 1960 or something, and you're thinking, there was just this assumption.
See, that's one of the problems that Queens College has, unfortunately. Our group was the first group to go to college in most cases. Almost mm-hmm. everybody that I knew, we were the first ones in our families mm-hmm. to go to college. But that was the first step up. Mm-hmm. But I really don't know anybody who went to Queens College whose children went mm-hmm. to Queens College. It wasn't like a, you know, you have, like, if you go to Cornell, you have a heritage there.
Right.
And all the guys that came later on, my son is much younger, he's only 25, but they all went to Brown, and they went to Yale, and they went to University of Pennsylvania. That was the next logical step.
I was the last year to get through totally free tuition. Then the year after I graduated, they instituted tuition above the fee. And I think that made a difference.
Yeah. You know,
free versus lots of money versus you're paying anyway.
Yeah. No, but it was definitely a factor. You know, when we get together and we talk about it, and we were talking about this, one of the guys, he was the one who brought it up, he said, yeah. He says, you know, we went to Queens College, but we wanted our kids to have the next step up the ladder. And you're right. When you went to high school, I mean, I don't know anybody that I know really thought of going to a major school. You didn't think you could get into a major school. You didn't even think of it. You thought of St. John's, right. You thought of NYU, you thought of, well, Hofstra and Adelphi weren't very good schools back in those days. As a matter of fact, there was a famous line in the Kingston House Frolic skit where we were kind of putting down the other schools, and we said, the line was something like, you can always go to, if you don't make it into Queens College, you can always go to Post at night, and then there was a pause, or Hofstra in the day.
Ooh.
And that was like the put down for the, because they weren't, you know, in the same league as Queens College. Right. In fact, same thing with Brooklyn College, and, you know, City College. They were like the beacons. Yeah.
The Harvard of the city.
They were. The only thing that was so bad is there was no campus here. I mean, one of the guys that sitting at the tent just now, he brought pictures of the campus in 1948.
It's a few buildings.
That was it. I mean, our new buildings were Clapper Library and the social science, SS1 they used to call it, and the dome.
Right. Well, those trailers had been here, were here forever.
Yeah.
Temp 1, Temp 2, Temp 3.
And there was no parking, which was always, you know, an issue. But it was just, you know, and it was, you know, you could come here by bus, we could walk. I used to walk here to school from my house, and it was maybe 3 miles. And it was, you didn't even think twice of it. And my girlfriend lived on 65th Avenue, so we would go down 65th Avenue to 174th Street and stuff. And,
But it seems like, I'm curious, did you stay in touch with the people from graduate school or your real friends came from here?
I don't have one friend from graduate school that I've kept in touch with. The irony is, this upcoming April is the 50th anniversary. And they asked me to be on the alumni reunion committee.
Oh, they're telling us to go?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, we're gonna. Okay, thank you.
But I mean, the guys that graduated me were people like Mario Gabelli, known as the Great Gabelli.
Right.
Okay, and all these guys are huge hedge funds and presidents of Pepsi Cola. And again, I took such a different path. I don't know if it was the right one. Looking back, I mean, next year will be the 50th anniversary of Good Times magazines that I started.
Okay.
And I took a job with AT&T, lasted there 3 months, and quit it to start it. I turned down a job offer to work for Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, that must be a
story. I had two job opportunities, work for Jimi Hendrix or go to work for AT&T. Hendrix was paying $95 a week and a 3-month plan. And AT&T was paying the amazing amount of $210 a week at the time.
Oh.
And I thought about it, and I went with AT&T.
Okay.
Never figuring that I would
actually
quit after 3 months.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah.
This has been such fun for me.
Well, it is fun. It is fun because, you know, particularly for us as you get older, there aren't a lot of people that you can exchange stories with. So with ourselves, it's almost like, you know, you're reliving it. And at the same time, there's unfortunately less and less guys. Guys are dying.
Yeah.
And you don't realize it until